Now let's ask ourselves the question, what do you think of a chain that is suspended between earth and moon? The chain is not anchored to earth, nor is it anchored to moon. It's simply a chain. And it has no beginning, and it has no end. It just simply hangs there. If you were to see a phenomenon like that through the telescope, I think you'd have to ask yourself a few rational questions. You know, like, I mean, what does it mean? Or further than that, if you wanted to think of it more seriously, why doesn't it connect? Or if you wanted to go back more philosophically, it doesn't have a beginning, it doesn't have an end. All it is a link of chain hanging there. You begin to reason about that and think about it. I mean, if you were a rational being, I think. And I think what you'd have to come up with is that that chain had to have some connection of the links between it. And that the connection that forged those links must also have had some capability to suspend it where it was. Because you see, if I see link after link after link, I must come to the conclusion that some intelligent source put the links at least together, even if there's no beginning to it or no end. I therefore inductively reason from the links to something with some degree of intellect that forged it. This is precisely what St. Thomas was trying to do, only he went about it deductively instead of inductively. And so he left us with a very good argument that a lot of Christians don't use. Here it is. If there now does exist a chain of causality, now we're talking about causes, that's suspended, then either it is itself eternal, it was just always there as a chain, or it originated in an eternal potential cause, or the chain just suddenly, at a given point in time and space, materialized. Now let's affirm the argument of reasonableness and of logic. Let's ask ourselves, there is a chain of causality, because we can go back in our own universe to its beginning with hydrogen atoms. Now it's hanging there. Where do we go from there? The reasonable thing is to attempt to find out what caused it, because we know it's an effect. We know that it's running down. We know it's going to be destroyed. So we start asking ourselves the question, what caused it? Not what caused me. We've traced me and you and the whole universe back to the beginning of the chain. What caused this effect? Now, at this particular juncture, we have our choices to make. Either it was caused by a power which brought it into existence, or it was always there. We know it wasn't always there because it's disintegrating, the universe, and the causes which we can observe, and the effects. So we are led inextricably back to the idea of a cause that brought that all into being. At that juncture, Bertrand Russell arises on the scene in his book, Why I Am Not a Christian. How many students have read that book in this room? How many Christians here have read the book? Oh, you're missing something. You want to read one of the most cogent statements of unbelief in print, Why I'm Not a Christian. In there, Russell comes to grip with this argument. What does he say? He says, granted we come back to the atoms, and granted we come back to what is an effect, why should we say that God, since he is the next step, the Christians affirm, is himself uncaused? It does not logically follow that if we come back to the atoms and then to him, that he cannot be caused by something greater than himself. You know, some Christians look at it and they say, that doesn't make any difference. It makes a lot of difference. Because if you get back to the atoms and back to the Creator, the philosopher and the unbeliever says, what makes you think that what created it wasn't caused? And the Christian has no logical defense at that point. So, you have to use, I think, a very excellent defense that somehow or other perturbs people who get to this point. And maybe you'd like to write it down, because whatever perturbs them is worth having around when you need it. Let's look at it for a second. Let's assume we get back from Grandmommy and Granddaddy Hydrogen Atom to God. All right? We're there. Now we appear in the presence of the deity and we have a philosophical dialogue for the sake of making it very plain and that we can grasp it instantly. Then we say, we have arrived at you, Creator, but it does not logically follow, sequentially, that you yourself are uncaused. And the Creator would say, absolutely accurate, perfectly logical and rational. I concur. Then where do you go? Because the Creator would rejoin, however, you have arrived at me. And I am, whether caused or uncaused, your Creator. Granted? Yes. Good. Why don't you obey me? And at that juncture, all philosophy, logic, and rationality disintegrates. Because there is no possible defense against a being who says, whether I'm caused or uncaused, I'm here. And what difference does it make if I have a cause and another God made me? I made you, and you are answerable to me in time and space. Now I'd like to know what you're doing with my son and with my gospel and with the revelation that I gave you approximately 2,000 years ago. What is the answer then of the philosopher and the unbeliever who has arrived at what he says can be? A deity who has a cause. His only answer can be, ah. That brings up another point of ethics and of choice and of free will. And the Creator's rejoinder would be, I gave you free will. I made you in my own image. We are now back at me. Where do you go from there? The answer is always going to be, no place. It's amazing to see how many Christians, afraid of making God finite, don't use the argument. I remember the first time I used it in a philosophy discourse. It was a very heated discussion. And we were arguing violently, about 12 or 15 of us, all budding philosophers, sitting around a coffee klatch at NYU. And everybody was pounding on contingency and pounding on causality and pounding on the non-necessity of being and pounding on this and pounding on that and generating enormous heat and no light whatsoever. As I was listening to it, I thought to myself, why not try it this way? So I looked into the group of my fellow students and I said, hey, let's look at it from a perspective of a theist. Oh, everybody laughed. You know, the theist, who pays any attention to the theist? I said, no, I'm serious for a minute. Give me some objectivity, some philosophical objectivity. Let's assume the argument of infinite regress. We are going back, 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 and we've arrived at the beginning of the cosmos. What is it according to the physicists? Well, hydrogen atoms, okay? Right. I said, all right, we're there now. And I said, we jump from that to another cause because we admit the universe is in effect. Okay. I said, that cause we call God. Now, we're not saying we're talking about the God of Christianity. We're just talking about an intelligent creator. All right. What's the next question? Everybody there said, not a single soul dissented. Everybody said. And they were all brilliant students. Why, obviously, that we must regress beyond X, that is, the God, and ask, who caused God? Splendid. But let's stop and ask ourselves the question, once we have arrived there, what about stopping the clock for a second and having a dialogue with X? Everybody said, what do you mean? I said, it's very simple. Let's let a theistic X talk to us. And the theistic X says just what I said a few moments ago. There wasn't one single person there at the table, nor the professor that taught us, who could come up with a logical argument against it, except to say they didn't believe it. Which, of course, is no logical argument whatsoever. It's simply an affirmation of one's own inner conviction. Now, that's worth thinking about. It's very much like the judge in Chicago who was faced with a group of hippies. And this was in the newspaper. And they had perpetrated some crimes and so forth, and they shook their fists at the judge and said, man, you haven't got the power from the people. It's contrary to the Constitution. You can't do that to us. We're going to appeal to the Supreme Court. And the judge answered them. He said, that's your prerogative under law. And you're right, I do not have the power of the Supreme Court. But I do have the power, as the judge sitting in this case, to decide on the merits of that case, and you who have offered a defense. And you have been convicted, and therefore I sentence you. I have enough power from the people to deal with you. Let's take the unbeliever back to that point and grant him any infinite regression he wants. The God he arrives at has enough power to deal with him. And the Christian will argue, of course, for an infinite God, but he can argue from that. And reasonably and rationally. At least Edgar Brightman thought you could. And he was a fairly good philosopher, even though he had a finite God. Now, I think also, and we have to bring this to its proper perspective, we also have to look at something else that's very, very important. That is teleology. Now, I want you to take your Bibles, because this is the supreme argument, I believe, from the Bible and from experience for the existence of God. And the Christian can use this. Obviously, we're not going to exhaust all of the things we could do this evening. It usually takes me a full semester on the arguments for the existence of God and the objections of the philosophers, and we're never going to get into it. But let's primarily, when I say the philosophers, incidentally, I mean unbelieving philosophers. There are some who are believers. It's a small minority, I assure you, but they are believers. I want to draw your attention to Psalm 94, verse 9. Because this is a biblical argument, and it's sound, it's logical, it'll stand, and we ought to know the form of it. Psalm 94. Verse 9. He that planted the ear, shall he not hear? He that formed the eye, shall he not see? Now I want you to take that and underline that verse. The planting of the ear and the planting of the eye. The psalmist says, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, the designer of the ear, he can't hear. The designer of the eye, he can't see. The argument is implicit right in the structure of the text, of design, of purpose. Hence the Greek word telos, or finality, the purpose, the design of the whole thing. The teleological argument for the existence of God. Now, there are many forms of it, but I think what we can say is this, quote, can we believe that the purposiveness of our sensory organs can be rationally explained without an intelligent purposer? Close quote. That's a good question from a Christian philosopher. Can we believe that the purposiveness of our sensory organs can be rationally explained without an intelligent purposer? Close quote. There are many ways that we can state the argument from teleology. It's used in different places in the Scripture. In Psalm 19, verse 5, we have another occurrence of it. And I'm going to go into some of the philosophers who have made some interesting comments on it, and very strongly in support of theism. Psalm 19:5. These verses you ought to know because they outline this, which I consider to be the strongest argument. And there are a number of philosophers who have arrived at the same thing. (Clears throat) The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night shows knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out throughout the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them hath he set a tabernacle for the sun, which is as a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, and rejoicing as a strong man to run his race. His going forth is from the end of the heaven, and his circuit to the ends of it, and there is nothing hid from the heat thereof. What are we seeing here? The argument from the design of the heavens. In other words, God designed it. How can you look and see law and purpose without inevitably asking the question, even if you're not trying to prove something, asking the question, is there not a purposer in this beyond what I personally am able to control? Now, we can go further than this. Romans chapter 10, verses 17 and 18, the Apostle Paul makes reference to this very point, arguing for the power and universality of God from teleology. And again, and he was no mean philosopher himself, the argument is found in Romans chapter 1. The invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly perceived, understood by the things which have been made, even his eternal power and divinity. So man stands without excuse. What is it that condemns men? That the invisible things of God are seen in the purposes of creation, so that man cannot have an excuse. Now, there are a number of people that have objected through the years to the argument from teleology. You'll find a disconcerting factor in dealing with unbelieving philosophers and people who attempt to sustain their arguments. They have a habit of only quoting what passages out of other philosophers that suits their case, and they omit other ones. Point in question. David Hume, the great empirical philosopher, brilliant genius of a man, who quite properly criticized deductive arguments for the existence of God and laid them to rest. And I am with him to the end. They should have been laid to rest. They simply obscured the facts. But Hume is always quoted, always, in every philosophy course I ever took. And I've interviewed literally hundreds of people on this subject, asking them questions to satisfy my own mind. I never heard anybody in any university or college ever quote David Hume positively on teleology or on the fact of God's existence or any evidence that could support it. Never once. He's always quoted as the man who destroyed the arguments for the existence of God. I'd like you to listen to the man who destroyed the arguments for the existence of God. From something that's not found in the class notes and in the assigned readings. Natural History of Religion, David Hume, quote, "The whole frame of nature bespeaks an intelligent author. No rational inquirer can, after serious reflection, suspend his belief a moment with regard to the primary principles of genuine theism and religion." Close quote. This comes as a shocker to a lot of people that think that Hume was trying to destroy it. In fact, in an interesting dialogue, which I took the trouble to bring along so that we might see it in its proper context, David Hume, according to the editor of these selections, made this statement. And I'm quoting now the editor of this series. "It may seem strange that defense of the teleological argument is undertaken in the following by one who apparently had little sympathy with it. However, it only emphasizes Hume's great philosophical ingenuity, for he does not shirk the task of putting the argument forcibly. The cause or causes of order in the universe probably bear some remote analogy to human intelligence." And then, listen, "The world is one vast machine and is divisible into a network of smaller and yet comparable machines that far outstrip human comprehension. Reasonable men," he says, quoting Hume, "are forced to conclude that the source of everything is a superior mind or intelligence." Close quote. Now, what interested me further was, in reading this particular synthesis of Hume, something here that I think a lot of Christians ought to be aware of, and I'll be happy to supply the references to it. It's found in The Cosmological Arguments, A Spectrum of Opinion. The chapter on David Hume, and the editor is Donald Barrill. And the publisher is a Doubleday publication from New York. I quote now, "Consider anatomatize the human eye. Survey its structure and contrivance." This is Hume now. "And tell me from your own feeling if the idea of a contriver does not immediately flow in upon you with a force like that of a sensation. The most obvious conclusion surely is in favor of design. And it requires time, reflection, and study to summon up those frivolous, though abstruse, objections which support unbelief. Who can behold the male and the female of each species, the correspondence of their parts and instincts, their passions, and whole course of life, before and after generation, but must be sensible that the propagation of the species is intended by nature? Millions and millions of such instances present themselves through every part of the universe, and no language can convey a more intelligible, irresistible meaning than the curious adjustment of final cause. Whatever arguments may be urged, an orderly world, as well as a coherent, articulate speech, will still be received as an incontestable proof of design and intention." And the conclusion, Hume again speaking through Cleanthes, "You can trace causes from effects. You can compare the most distant and remote objects. And your greatest errors proceed not from barrenness of thought and invention, but from too luxuriant a fertility, which suppresses your natural good sense by a profusion of unnecessary scruples and objections." And he concludes, "The order and arrangement of nature, the curious adjustment of final causes, the plain use and intention of every part and organ, all these bespeak in the clearest language an intelligent cause or author. The heavens and the earth join in the same testimony. The whole chorus of nature raises one hymn to the praises of its creator." And then he says, speaking to the man who's arguing with him, "You start abstruse doubts, cavils, and objections. You ask me what is the cause of this cause. I don't know, and I don't care. It doesn't concern me. I have found a deity." You notice the point we returned to a moment ago? "I have found a deity. And here I stop my inquiry." In other words, if you regress back to the universe and then to its cause, Hume says, "I have found the deity. I don't have to go any further beyond that, because that deity is sufficient to explain all of the effects in my universe." And that's a reasonable, logical, and rational argument from design. It'll stand up. And it didn't come from a Christian. It came from a deistic empirical philosopher who thought that it had some good common sense behind it. The man who's always quoted as saying that he was opposed to belief in the existence of God. I'm glad we can bury that criticism of Dr. Hume. I'm also glad that probably the greatest of all logicians, John Stuart Mill, was very interested in what Hume had to say. And this is what Dr. Mill ended by saying. You see, the philosophers can, on the existence of God, occasionally give us a tremendous boost. Let's listen to it. He says, "The number of instances," now he's talking about the order and the general likeness and composition, and he again cites the human eye. He's going back to Hume. "The number of instances is immeasurably greater than is by the principles of inductive logic required for the exclusion of a chance concurrence of independent causes." Translation, the fact of the evidence and the way it's arranged in the purpose of the human eye is far greater than can be explained by chance. What chance creates, chance destroys. It is perfectly possible, theoretically, for the universe to all have come into existence simply by being thrown together from atomic structure and arrived at where we are now, granting you have an eternal universe. But, says this philosopher, and others, the possibility of this occurring on the basis of chance does not take into consideration that the same forces which caused it to instantly coalesce will also cause it to instantly disintegrate. And from its creation till now, we've had 12.25 billion years, and the disintegration has not taken place. We do not have infinite time. We have finite time. Therefore, the argument will stand. And I think that Dr. Mill has summed it up beautifully when he says, the number of instances is immeasurably greater than is by the principles of inductive logic required for the exclusion of a random or a chance concurrence of independent causes, or speaking technically, for the elimination of chance. This I conceive to be, he's going on now, we are therefore warranted by the canons of induction in concluding that what brought all these elements together was some common to them all, some cause common to them all. And inasmuch as the elements agree in the single circumstance of conspiring to produce sight, there must be some connection by way of causation between the cause which brought these elements together and the fact of sight. This I conceive to be a legitimate inductive inference and the sum and substance of what induction can do for theism. Close quote. That may not mean a great deal to the average Christian, but that statement by John Stuart Mill, at whose altar almost all philosophers bow as the greatest of logicians, leads us to theism being substantiated by what? Good, solid inference and induction. And it'll stand. This did not again come from a Christian, but from an unbeliever. Now, some people are sitting here saying, there's a lot of heavy stuff. And, man, how am I going to put all this together? Well, fortunately for you, it's all on a cassette, and you can play it over and over and over again, courtesy of One Way Library, until you've thoroughly absorbed all of this information. And then you'll be able to use it. But the point is, once you have heard it enough and listened to it enough, then it becomes part of your vocabulary of conversation with the person that has these arguments. And when that happens, you are able to communicate with them. I had a professor who once said, we are always being told that the universe came into existence by chance and is sustained by chance. He said, I'm reminded of the story of the infinite monkey at the infinite typewriter who is pounding out consistently, and eventually by the laws of chance, he is going to come up with Shakespeare's Hamlet. One day, into this great infinite laboratory rushes the scientist who is controlling the experiment, and he tears off the top page from the typewriter and says, I've got it! I've got it! I've got it! We're vindicated! To be or not to be, that is the Geschrugelsund. If you think about it for a moment, it makes a lot of sense. What chance creates, to be or not to be, ends up in Geschrugelsund. Why? Because there is no purpose and no design. You see the importance of purpose and design. We can argue from the human eye. God said so. And it turns out that God is buttressed in his opinion by no less a logician than John Stuart Mill, which I'm sure impresses all Christians and has impressed God for ages. We find out that David Hume, the dean of empiricists, far from standing with the sword and the shield and the meat cleaver, turns around and says, nobody that's got a grain of intelligence can look at nature and not come up with the fact that there is a theistic basis in all this. And that's what he said. And there are just scores and scores and scores of people who are not philosophers who have come to precisely the same conclusion. Now we can go on to Bertrand Russell, but you'd be asleep. We could go on to Ludwig Feuerbach and you couldn't pronounce his name. We could go on to all of the rest of them and see each of the facets of modern unbelief. But to conclude, the Christian has a pretty sound basis for belief in a cosmological structure and argument. There is such a thing as existence. And if anything now exists, then either something must be eternal or something not eternal must have emerged from nothing. It is more reasonable to believe that something is eternal, and the God of biblical theology is the most reasonable option to all of it. There are only four choices you've got, and each one of the four choices has been examined and inductively analyzed. Causality, is here. And if you run into infinite regression, then you can always remember that when you get there, you can ask the nasty question from the position of that being, what have you been doing in my universe? And the answer from anybody who wants to really face it is that he's not going to sit still for an argument about where he came from. He's instead going to ask for your arguments for what you've done. I think that this is a reasonable position. If there now does exist a chain of causality, then either it is itself eternal as a chain, or it is originated in an eternal potential cause, or it originated from nothing. And finally, teleology. God said it. I planted the ear, I planted the eye. Use your brains. Look at them. Think about them. And it won't be any great giant intellect that comes to the conclusion that there's purpose and reason and authority in creation. The existence of God, demonstrable by scientific means, incredible. Can never be done. God will not get into a test tube and change color like litmus paper. Red, yellow, or blue, I'm here. Lucky you. God doesn't do it this way. There are other kinds of proof and good, solid reasoning that can buttress it. Let's not deify any methodology, and let's not think that what we've gone through this evening is the be-all and the end-all of argumentation. But it is a reasonable, logical alternative to unbelief. And it will give us some sustenance beyond Scripture for the reasonableness of the existence of God.